This is a criminal antitrust case in which Mr. Vandenbroek pleaded guilty to entering into three relatively small agreements to fix the price of ready-mix concrete in rural northwest Iowa. He pleaded guilty pursuant to an agreement with the Department of Justice's antitrust division under Rule 11C1C that provided for a sentence of 19 months. The district court rejected that plea agreement. Mr. Vandenbroek persisted with his guilty plea, and the district court thereafter sentenced him to 48 months, which is tied with one other case for the longest time.
Wait a minute.
You say he rejected it. I thought the district court said he was inclined to reject it and said, but you can go forward or you've got about a 10% chance of convincing me. So was there ever an outright ruling where the district court rejected it?
Yes, I believe there was twice. And the first and most important one was before the May 26, 2010 hearing that Your Honor is referring to. And that is 6 days before that, the district court issued an order. It's page one of the addendum. In that order, the district court unambiguously says it is not going to be bound by the plea agreement. Everything that happened at that May 26th hearing was against the backdrop of an order that had already announced that the plea agreement was a dead letter. And so thereafter, Mr. Vandenbroek persists with his guilty plea, and he is then sentenced to 48 months, which is the longest antitrust sentence in history, tied with one other. We submit that the errors in this case predominantly stem from one thing. And that is that the district court, for categorical and policy-driven reasons not specific to this case, decided to use this case as a vehicle to rewrite antitrust sentencing law in the United States. There are two...
Well, let's have at it, though, on that issue. Did the district court judge... he gave him an opportunity. This is what... I'm not going to be bound by it, and so you better... get together with your lawyer, discuss this, because you can have that, and we'll go to trial, and we'll see where this thing all ends up. Did that happen, or did he say, didn't give you an opportunity to reconnoiter, as we call it?
Well, he gave the parties an opportunity to confer, which they did. They then persisted in the guilty plea, but with a modification to the plea agreement, converting it from a subsection C agreement, in which the sentence was set at 19 months, to a subsection B agreement in which the parties agreed on what they would recommend to the district court, but the district court, even if it accepted the agreement, would not be bound by the agreement.
Why is that not a waiver on your client?
Because for a couple of reasons. First, it puts the defendant in the position of having no ability to challenge the exercise or the abuse of discretion in rejecting the agreement unless he enters into no agreement with the government. The only way he could raise this error is by going to trial or by entering into a blind plea with no agreement with the government. And particularly here, where the rejection is based upon a categorical reason, where the judge says, it's my judicial philosophy, I'm just not going to do this in a white-collar case of this sort, you have an error that, to borrow a phrase from another context, is capable of repetition yet evading review, that there would be no way for defendants in situations like this to ever be able to raise the issue of the error in the rejection of the plea.
Well, acceptance of a C agreement is purely discretionary with the trial court, isn't it?
Well, it is discretionary with the trial court, but it is discretionary in the ordinary sense of that term. That is, it is reviewed by this court for abuse of discretion. It is possible, therefore, for district courts to err in rejecting such plea agreements.
Can you direct me to a case in which this circuit has reversed a district judge for rejecting a C agreement?
I cannot direct the court to one.
I couldn't find one, so I thought maybe your researchers were better than mine. But it seems to me that that he has almost unlimited discretion, because this is a fundamental responsibility of a United States district judge, and that's his sentencing responsibility, and he can handle it as he sees fit procedurally, can't he?
I agree that it is a fundamental exercise of the district court's discretion. And I also will agree that there is no case going our direction in the Eighth Circuit because the issue has come up very rarely nationwide. There's also no case in the Eighth Circuit going the other way, saying in the post-guidelines era that the district court's discretion is unfettered and that without penalty it can reject such an agreement for any reason.
I'll bet you can find other district judges who, in the course of their operations, have announced that they would never be bound by a C agreement for reasons that, of their position. So I hope that when you get beyond, and I'll not hold you up on this point, but when I hope you get to your second point, because I do have some trepidation about that.
I will go straight there in just a moment, Your Honor. I would say this. I suspect there are district judges who just categorically would never abide by 11C1C agreement for the reasons described in the Morgan case, which we think from the Ninth Circuit correctly states the law in this area. That is simply error. That is not a position that a district judge is allowed to take. The existence of discretion requires the exercise of that discretion. The reason there is not a lot of law on this is that defendants don't typically appeal those decisions, or if the district judge's predilection against C1C agreements is known, they don't try them in front of that judge in the first place. I would now like to turn to the sentence in this case, which has both procedural and substantive components of error. And the first is procedural error in two different respects. The first having to do with the district court's policy decision to reject the antitrust guideline, essentially in favor of a fraud-based calculation under the familiar fraud guideline.
Let me ask you this. You know, we're in a different era in sentencing, and you know this well. And Spears' case, which is our court and is my case that got reversed by the Supreme Court, essentially said that the Supreme Court is saying that the courts can consider their own policy considerations in these cases. And why is the district, assuming everything you say is true, that the judge just had a policy of thinking that the antitrust violation sentences were too low? So why is that not fall clearly within Spears and the Supreme Court recent precedent?
Because Spears and Kimbrough were specifically about the crack cocaine powder disparity guideline.
Yeah, but the decision wasn't limited to that. I mean, it was a very broad statement. The sentencing judges can consider their policy considerations in sentencing.
I believe that a careful inspection of Kimbrough reveals this, that sentencing judges are able to use their own policy views to disagree with the guidelines in a mine run case where the sentencing commission failed to act pursuant to its traditional agency type role. Normally, guidelines are composed based upon empirical research and expertise of the sentencing commission, and there's no dispute in this case that that's how the antitrust guideline came about. On the other hand, the crack cocaine powder distinction was based essentially on a political consideration. The Sentencing Commission itself didn't like it. And so Spears and Kimbrough were built upon a case where the Sentencing Commission's exercise of discretion was not used properly. It basically wasn't exercised at all.
Can you cite to me, or at least relate to me, any place in Spears or Kimbrough that limited the Supreme Court's application of the policy discretion of the district court to the crack cocaine area, or sentences that are political rather than empirical?
I don't have the Kimbrough text in front of me, but when I come back for rebuttal, I'll give the court the page numbers that I refer to for that, because I think that clearly is what Kimbrough says, that the district court's ability to vary on policy grounds is not unfettered, but instead turns on the degree to which, if you will, the Sentencing Commission fell down on the job. And that if the Sentencing Commission used its traditional institutional tools to craft the guideline, then closer review on appeal of the policy disagreement is required. And actually, if the court searches for the words closer review in Kimbrough, that is the passage in which the court makes that clear. Nothing about Spears later on is inconsistent with that, nor do I think anything about this court's post-Kimbrough jurisprudence is inconsistent with that.
Counsel, with Kimbrough and Spears, my reading of those cases, the deference that the district judge has in sentencing, it bottoms on a variance under 3553A. Here, my problem a little bit is that you must start with an advisory guideline calculation, and that's procedural. Did the advisory guideline that the district judge used here, was it calculated on the antitrust guidelines or the fraud guidelines?
At the risk of being jocular, the answer is yes. Here's what the district court judge did. He did both. He calculated the antitrust guideline under 2R1.1 and then, for a very extensive set of policy reasons, said, I think this guideline is wrong. And so for Mr. Vandenbroek and for the other two in this scheme, for Mr. Stewart and Mr. Van Zee, he then calculated with great specificity an alternative guideline under the fraud guideline, 2B1.1.
Which came out about the fraud guideline, that the advisory guideline that it seems to me he departed from for his variance was the fraud guideline, and it was a guideline that was commensurate with the sentence that he gave. But is that
that's exactly the problem, is that he gave...
So are we talking then about a procedural defect in what he did as opposed to a defect in the variance under 355A? That's my question.
And I would submit both. Procedurally, the question is whether he is entitled to consider his policy disagreement with 2R1.1 at all.
Well, procedurally, he had to do a guideline from which to vary, right?
Right. Yes, he did.
Okay. Did he do that?
Yes, he did.
Did he do that using the antitrust?
Yes, he did.
Guidelines? Is that the advisory guideline from which he varied, or did he vary from the alternate guideline, which was the fraud guideline that gave him
He varied upward as a formal matter. He varied upward from the antitrust guideline, but as a matter of substance, what he really did was sentence all three defendants based upon the fraud guideline. And Mr. Vandenbroek was within the fraud guideline, and Mr. Stewart and Mr. Van Zee, in his view, merited downward variances from the fraud guideline. Now,
if that's true, then he took himself right into the area where he has almost the complete deference that Judge Riley mentioned, and he used the fraud guidelines to do his variance under 3553A. So I'm at a loss to see where the error would be.
Well, the line between, and the cases say this, that the line between procedural and substantive error in a case like this can be a little fuzzy. But regardless, it is plain that what he did is that he varied based upon a policy consideration that was not specific to Mr. Vandenbroek. There is a whole lot more in this 108-page opinion about sentencing policy than there is about Mr. Vandenbroek. And that's why the district court proclaims in this case, and this is a quote, that he is changing the status quo of antitrust sentence.
Why is this any different? You have a district judge here who's saying, I think that the guidelines are too low. And how is that any different than the Spears and Kimbrough cases where they district judges were saying, I think the guidelines are too high. And as a matter of policy, I'm going to vary down. And here you have the judge saying, as a matter of policy, I'm going to vary up.
It's different because Kimbrough and Spears are based upon a guideline that had no empirical support. The Sentencing Commission did not do its job by admission when it crafted that guideline. Here, as the government concedes, the antitrust guideline...
No, but they were following the statutes. I mean, that was based on congressional... You're right, a political decision, but it was based on law.
Well, it was trying to mimic the statutory sentencing scheme, but the Sentencing Commission was by no means obligated to do that. It decided to do it and cast aside any empirical study in so doing. I see that I'm down to about 5 minutes. I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal with the
Certainly.
Court's permission. Thank you very much.
Good morning. Is it Mr. Font?
Fonte.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am John Fonte from the Department of Justice representing the United States today. Your Honors, regarding the rejection of the C agreement, I think I only really have one comment unless the Court has specific questions, and that is that when they went into the courtroom that day on that hearing, the issue was not a dead letter. The Court...
Well, that's what concerns me here, and it's what counsel argued, is that the judge prejudged the case.
Correct, Your Honor. But if it was a categorical prejudgment, I don't think the judge would have made the offer, which was very sincere. He said, we can take this right through the sentencing hearing. I can get the PSR. You could do your allocution. I'll have all the information I'll have. And I don't think he did say, you know, you have maybe a 10% chance that I change your mind, because he did have a very strong feeling about the antitrust guideline probably being too lenient in Mr. Vandenbrink's case as compared to the fraud guideline. But I think his offer was sincere, and that offer was on the table when Mr. Vandenbrink decided to, the judge had not ruled on the C agreement, and it was on the table when the judge when Mr. Vandenbrink decided to go ahead and change the agreement and enter into the new agreement that he submitted to the Court. So I would say that under those circumstances, there was definitely a waiver of the argument that there was any abuse of discretion with respect to the C agreement.
Well, why do you think that it's within a district court's discretion to just write out certain guidelines, in this case antitrust guidelines, just say a matter of my personal view is they're too low, and I'm going to look in the guidelines and find some other guideline I think is more appropriate, and here he chooses the fraud guidelines. And applies so how, you know, there's discretion. Yes, there's discretion, but why is this that really go beyond discretion to just a personal decision of the judge and not follow the law and the guideline?
Again, Your Honor, I think that the argument that Mr. Vandenbrink is making, that the Court just threw the antitrust guideline out the window and replaced it with the fraud guideline, is absolutely wrong. On addendum page 145, the Court says with respect to Mr. Stewart that, excuse me, the antitrust guideline sentencing range of 12 to 18 months was both adequate and sufficient to accomplish the goals of sentencing. And on page 116 of the addendum, he said, after balancing the 3553A factors, the range provided by the antitrust guidelines of 21 to 27 months is inadequate and insufficient to accomplish the goals of sentencing.
He told the Sentencing Commission they didn't know what they were doing, right?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. I mean, he certainly had... He had a belief that, in general, the antitrust guideline was too lenient, primarily because the antitrust guideline does not take into consideration co-conspirator conduct like most other conspiracies do.
So how does that... I don't follow how that isn't saying to the Sentencing Commission, with respect, gentlemen and ladies... you just did a bum job here because fraud considerations would have been better for you to use just as a fundamental approach to this thing.
Well, Your Honor, I think what he was saying is that the commission has never explained why it doesn't take into consideration co-conspirator conduct in antitrust cases. They just did that. We don't know why they did that. And he was at a loss as to why that was, and he, I think, had discretion to disagree with that. But I think more importantly, Judge Beam, the court's decision was not just based on the fraud guideline. It was based on an evaluation of the 3355 factors, and it was a situation where this particular judge found this particular defendant both uniquely greedy and uniquely remorseless.
Well, notwithstanding your counsel on the other side, it seems to me that he took the 3553A items, and which was within his discretion, and simply said they are more appropriately applied to the fraud guideline. And so really the variances that he made here were from the fraud guidelines. And it seems to me that this wasn't a fraud conviction. This was an antitrust conviction. And I'm hard for me to see how a district judge has that kind of authority, even under Speer and Kimbrough.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that's what happened at all, because he sentenced Mr. Stewart within the guidelines. There's nothing in the opinion that suggests
Within the fraud guidelines, he did indeed sentence within the fraud guidelines, but not within the antitrust guidelines.
No, Your Honor. He sentenced Mr. Vanderbreek to a period of imprisonment that was within the fraud guideline range and not the antitrust guideline
range. That's what I'm saying.
But with respect to Stewart, in the same opinion, he sentenced him to a within antitrust guideline range. And there's nothing in the opinion, Your Honor, to suggest that he started at the fraud level and varied down. He said his finding, and again, this is on addendum page 116, it's on addendum 145, is that balancing the 3553 factors, the range of 12 to 18 months for Mr. Stewart for an antitrust violation was sufficient to accomplish the goals.
Well, he as I read the record and his opinion, he used the fraud guideline against Mr. Vanderbreek because he was a rich man after having sold his ready mix business, and he was just a greedy guy and didn't participate in community events or commit himself to charities and so forth. So he took that as the reason that he decided to apply the fraud guideline at 46 to 52 months, and he sentenced him to 48 months right within the fraud guidelines. It's hard for me to see how the record supports what you're saying.
Your Honor, he certainly did compare the antitrust range to the fraud range, but I think as this court's decision in United States versus Hill, which I believe Judge Riley wrote, the court concluded that comparison to other types of crimes is certainly within the district court's discretion,
sure,
because he was only using the fraud guideline here, again, as one factor, Your Honor, in order to help him calibrate the relative severity of Mr. Vanderbreek's conduct and fashion an appropriate sentence. And in the the Hill case, for example, the guideline range was 15 to 21 months, and the defendant was sentenced to a 51-month sentence, and this court upheld that as not an abuse of discretion. And again, I do want to make one point. Vanderbreek's counsel was wrong when he said that the court calculated the fraud range for Mr. Van Zee. He never did that. He calculated the antitrust guideline range, and he found that the range actually was too high in his estimation after he balanced the 3553 factors. And he substantially departed down from a 6 to 12-month range where the government was recommending an 8-month sentence to a 45-day sentence.
I thought on pages 87 and 88 of his opinion, the trial judge's opinion, he did the calculation of the fraud guideline of 46 to 57 months. I think if you'll look on 87 and 88 of the court's opinion.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
He did indeed do a fraud guideline calculation.
Yes, Your Honor. What I'm saying is defense counsel said that he did that same calculation for Vanderbreck, Stewart, and Van Zee.
And while he did do it
for Vanderbreck and Stewart, he did not do it for Van Zee. He just sentenced him straight. And again, I think you have to look at that as part of what the judge was doing. He wrote an opinion in which he sentenced both Mr. Vanderbreck and Mr. Van Zee. And he calculated Mr. Stewart's range under the guideline, which again was higher than it would have been. And he said that weighed somewhat in favor of an upward variance. But there were other factors in 3553 that drove him to sentence within. And that's what happened with Mr. Vanderbreck as well. Again, the comparison range under the fraud guideline was just one factor. I think it was a legitimate, under this court's Hill decision, use of the fraud guideline to help him calibrate the relative severity of Mr. Vanderbreck's crime, which again, the judge saw Mr. Vanderbreck as uniquely greedy and uniquely remorseless. Here was an individual who was wealthy when he started this. He was aware of the antitrust division's prosecutions in his particular industry, and he told the judge that that wasn't a sufficient deterrent because he thought he wouldn't get caught. The court thought he was ruthless. He was the instigator of these conspiracies. And the court held against him the fact that he did this three separate times. The court held that against him, gave great weight to that, where he said that if I gave you a sentence three times what I gave Mr. Stewart, it probably would not be enough. And that's on Government Appendix page 26. And even though he was rich beyond imagination, he told the court he became richer than he ever thought he would be, he continued to press in these conspiracies, and he even started the third one after he sold the company and was worth more money than he ever thought he would be. And the court just thought that he was ruthless beyond compare. And that.
Let me ask you this, and this may be more of a question for Mr. Weinhardt, but I would think your argument also is that the district court appeared to bulletproof this sentence by going given an alternative sentence based on consecutive sentences under 3584 and 3553A. Do you think that is legitimate, that the district court can do all these calculations and then come back and say, by the way, alternatively, I would give the same sentence by just stacking the sentences?
Again, Your Honor, he did base that on his 3553 analysis, the consecutive sentences. And I think, as we said in our brief, the weight that the judge gave Mr. Vanderbreck's history and characteristics would sufficiently, in the government's mind, would sufficiently support such an outcome. Certainly this court may disagree with that.
I'm talking more about just, legally. Do you think a district judge can bulletproof a sentence and just give an alternative sentence and say, well, I would give that sentence anyway by taking another avenue, in this case, 3584, essentially consecutive sentences, just stacking them?
Well, I think what the judge was saying by doing that, Your Honor, was that he saw Mr. Vanderbreck, and he was certainly able to observe him during Mr. Vanderbreck's testimony, and he found Mr. Vanderbreck's conduct to be very...
Well, you're getting into the facts. I want to talk about the legality of doing it. Do you think a judge can bulletproof a sentence like that?
I think the judge had discretion to, under the facts of this case, to order consecutive sentences, Your Honor. The terminology that you're using to bulletproof it, I think the judge had discretion under the statutes to do what he did in that regard, yes. Um, I just want to make one point with respect to the closer review that's required. Again, I think as this court did in the Hill decision, I think that means nothing more than ensuring that the court's decision and sentence was the product of careful and considered analysis, which it certainly was here. I, like Judge Riley asked earlier, I don't see any difference between the crack cocaine ratio and this case or the interstate transportation for prostitution guideline that was involved in the Hill case. The Supreme Court has given very broad discretion to district courts to vary from the guidelines. And while the judge certainly did see the antitrust guideline as being too lenient when compared to the fraud guideline, that was just one of the 3553A factors that he considered in his analysis. And the bottom line is that he did a total 3553 analysis. His ultimate imposition of the 48 months was based on that and is therefore not an abuse of discretion. The court has no further questions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Fonte. How much time does Mr. Weinhardt have?
He has 5 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay. Okay, did you find the quotation in Kimbrough or Spears?
I did, Your Honor. The court can tell I spent a lot of time reading and thinking about that case. I would direct the court to the material at pages 109 and 110 of the U.S. Reporter version. And I can't read a single sentence, but where the court talks about when closer review is warranted and when it's not, that's where we get into the distinction about did the Sentencing Commission do its job correctly or did it not. And that's what defines when a district court has freedom to, if it can come up with a compelling justification, vary on policy grounds. Now, in this case, there's no question that this was a policy-driven decision. Judge Bennett calculated a fraud guideline calculation for all three defendants, and I beg to differ with the government's counsel. I would direct the court to page 113 through 115 of the Van Zee sentencing transcript, and the court will see there that he walked through the fraud type analysis for Mr. Van Zee as well. He simply found that Van Zee and Stewart were entitled to a downward variance from that much higher or fraud-based calculation. I also think that this court's opinion in Hill is inapposite. Hill was a factually driven case, horrible facts, and there was not an alternative calculation. It is not as though the district judge in Hill calculated an alternative guideline under fraud or something that he thought was superior. He just quickly touched on a number of different crimes ranging from drugs to child pornography and said, against the panoply of all criminal offenses, this seems light to me based on these facts. That's not what happened in this case. What happened in this case is that Judge Bennett used the fraud guideline to produce the first upward variance ever in 275 guideline antitrust sentences. And in so doing, he imposed, in a case where the amount of commerce involved was small, a relatively pedestrian conspiracy, he imposed a sentence that was many times larger than the average for the typical kind of case. And then we get to the other procedural problem in the case, which is the consideration of disparity. 3553A6 requires a district court to consider unwarranted disparities with similarly situated defendants. And Kimbrough says that district courts have to take account of sentencing practices in other courts in making their decisions. But the district court here did the opposite. He embraced disparity. He touted the fact that he was creating disparity with other defendants. In fact, in the Van Zee sentencing, he says, and this is at page 105, you can't have a policy disagreement, sentence pursuant to that policy disagreement, and not have disparity. Setting aside the Kimbrough issue, the disparity here we think is a plain procedural error. He took a factor that the statute explicitly directs that he factor into his sentencing decision, and he went the exact opposite direction of what that statute requires. I'd like to talk for just a moment then about our substantive error claim here.
Before you do, what sure. about my question about the bulletproofing, the consecutive sentences under 3584? Why is that not just, you know, everything else you've been arguing is out the window because the judge alternatively would have just stacked them?
Because if the judge stacks under the sentencing guidelines law, which talks about what you do if you cap out against statutory maximums, you still have to do that stacking in the first instance based upon a correct guideline calculation. Then when you turn to the concurrent consecutive statute, that statute says that the district court has to base the stacking, if he's going to do it, on 3553A considerations. So we've really just gone into a circle and come back to the exact same place. Whether it is done in consecutive sentencing on multiple counts or whether it is done in a single sentence applicable to all counts, the sentence still needs to be based on a correct guideline calculation. It still needs to be substantively reasonable, and it still cannot create unwarranted disparities with similarly situated defendants.
Well, I thought he did the 3584 using the antitrust violations.
Well, he did so
his
using
guidelines.
He did so using the antitrust guidelines. But as the court can see, the analysis is very, very skinny there. He's simply repeating what he did before. And even if those are based on the antitrust guidelines formally, in substance, they were based on the fraud guidelines. And so where in substance he has used the wrong guideline explicitly so, that's a procedural error, and that should be...
Okay, your time's up, but I give you 1 minute to explain. You wanted to go into your, what, substantive unreasonable argument?
Yes. It bears repeating, this is tied for the longest antitrust sentence ever. It is a historical and national outlier, and... even if the district court was entitled as a procedural matter to consider its policy disagreement, even if it was entitled to consider disparity, it was not entitled to weigh those things nearly this much. Your Honor's opinion in Kane gets it exactly right. Procedure is what do you consider? Substance is did you make inappropriate weighing decisions? And here, having the longest sentence in history is the product of inappropriate weighing decisions. Your Honor, Judge Beam, in your dissent in Feimster, you asked, are we ever going to find the case that we say is substantively unreasonable? Well, in Kane, we found it on the high side. Here, I think we found it on the opposite side.
Well, and Kane's on the low side.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, in Kane, we found it on the low side. Here, I think that we've found it on the high side. If the court thinks about the longest pure marijuana distribution sentence in history, or thinks about the longest pure illegal alien harboring sentence in history, and thinks about the facts of that case compared to the mine run, the court would find very extreme cases. But that's not what happened in here. Here is a okay. very mine
your
run.
Your time's case. Expired.
All right. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Appreciate it. It is a different case, and you presented it well, both sides, and we appreciate your arguments. We'll be back to you in due course.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.